Okay, you ready? Okay, can you turn in your Bibles to Revelation chapter 11? I was talking about this last time and talking about the two witnesses. And in verse 11 it says this: "And after 3 days and a half, the Spirit of life from God entered into them," the two witnesses, "and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them which saw them. And they heard a great voice from heaven saying unto them, Come up here. And they ascended up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them. And the same hour was there a great earthquake, and a tenth part of the city fell. And in the earthquake were slain of men 7,000, and the remnant were frightened and gave glory to the God of heaven." The remnant here is the faithful believing remnant of Israel. But they only become a faithful believing remnant at this time. Is this event that makes them realize who really the Messiah is and exactly who the true God is. Now, the reason why this is so significant is because Jesus taught, if you're here the last time I spoke, that he was only going to do one more sign for Israel, and that was the sign of bringing back somebody from the dead. Jonah actually died when he drowned in the Mediterranean Sea. He literally sank to the bottom of the sea. That in itself is a supernatural act. We know he sank to the bottom because he said there were mountains there. And it wasn't until about the 1850s or something like that that they realized that there were actually mountains on the bottom of the ocean. Till then they thought the ocean bed was totally flat. So once again, the Bible proved to be right. And the fact that he knew that shows exactly where he ended up. Now, Jesus did the sign of the resurrection when he raised Lazarus from the dead. A lot of people believed at that time, but it did not lead to the salvation of the nation of Israel. Jesus himself rose from the dead, but it still did not lead to the salvation of the nation of Israel. 3,000 people were saved on the day of Pentecost and 5,000 shortly after that. A lot of people were saved, but it never led to the salvation of the nation of Israel. That means that in the future, there has to be a raising of the dead that will lead to that salvation. And this is the raising of the dead that's going to lead to it. From this time on, there'll be a strong move in Israel from the middle of the Great Tribulation till the time will come eventually where Israel as a nation will know that Jesus is their Messiah. And this is very important because this is exactly what the Bible teaches will happen. If you turn to the book of Matthew, chapter 23... before Jesus made the Olivet Discourse. And this is what it says. Verse 37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who killed the prophets, and you stoned them which are sent unto you, how often would I have gathered your children together, even as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you would not have it. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, you shall not see me again, till you say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Or in Hebrew, Baruch Haba B'Shem Adonai. According to Jesus, they're never going to see him again until they acknowledge that he really is the Saviour. This is also taught in the Old Testament. If you go to the book of Hosea, chapter 5, verse 13... Hosea is the book after Daniel. When is this going to happen? Now, the book of Hosea is largely about the marital covenant between Jehovah or Yahweh and the nation of Israel. And Hosea is actually told to marry someone who is a prostitute because she symbolizes Israel. Israel have prostituted themselves before God. The book of Ezekiel points this out, that Israel and Judah behaved like two prostitutes. And in the end, Judah were even worse than Israel. In the end, Judah went further in their rebellion against God than what Israel did. Because Judah actually sacrificed their own sons in the fire to Moloch. Israel never did that. But that's what they did. Two kings called Ahaz and Manasseh did that very act. In the end, they were even worse. So in the end, what happened to Israel originally would happen to Judah. Now, Hosea has three children. And the first child is called Jezreel. Jezreel means God scatters and God sows. One day God will scatter the nation of Israel, but one day he will sow them again in the land. And that's what we have seen happening. He scattered them after two wars with the Romans. After the second war with the Romans, the second war happened between 132 and 135 AD. Hadrian was the emperor, and it was actually made a law that no Jew from that time on could even enter the city of Jerusalem. It eventually led to a scattering throughout 90 different countries, a worldwide scattering that was originally predicted in Deuteronomy chapter 29. When Mark Twain went to Israel in 1867, he said it was the most barren place on the earth, that apart from Jerusalem, there was practically no life at all there, that 8,000 Jews lived in Jerusalem and only 2,000 lived in the rest of the nation of Israel. There were 10,000 Jews there. The regathering of Israel really started in 1881 after a Russian prince was killed and the Jews were blamed for it. And it's since gone on regathering. God is starting to sow Israel again in the nation of Israel. But this prophecy won't be totally fulfilled until we get to the millennial kingdom. Now in chapter 5, verse 13, it tells you when the nation of Israel as a nation will really come to Christ. Sorry, verse 15 it should be. Now this is God speaking. He says, I will go and return to my place. Where is God's place? God's place is in heaven. That means that he has to leave heaven in order to return to it. When did God leave heaven? When he became a man in the person of Jesus. He came down on earth and earth became his special place of residence for 30 odd years, not heaven. Till they have acknowledged their offense, a specific offense. This is exactly what Leviticus 26 teaches, that the total fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant will never happen until they have acknowledged a certain offense. And there it says the offense. In other words, it's the worst offense that they ever committed against God. The worst thing that they ever committed against God was to reject Jesus as their Messiah and King. They're going to have to acknowledge it. And seek my face. To seek God's face means to seek his blessing. In their affliction, they will seek me early or earnestly. The affliction is talking about is the great tribulation. This is what it says in the next chapter. Come and let us return unto the Lord, for he has torn and he will lead us or heal us. He has smitten and he will bind us up. After 2 days will he revive us, and on the third day he will raise us up and we shall live in his sight. Then shall we know if we follow on to know the Lord, his going forth is prepared as the morning, and he shall come unto us as the rain, as the latter and former rain unto the earth. Israel would pray for their rains. One would come in the spring, one would come in the autumn, and they would actually pray beforehand that it would come, because it was very important for the rain to come. It's very important for the Messiah to come. He's going to come after 3 days after they say this prayer. In Isaiah 64, it talks about part of this prayer. And one part of the prayer is that he would come and rend down the mountains. We know that at the time of Christ, when he does come, that a great deal of mountains are suddenly going to completely collapse and the whole topography of the earth is going to completely change. The Bible teaches that in passages like Revelation chapter 16. So in the millennial kingdom, there's only going to be one real mountain, Mount Zion, where Christ himself is going to reign. Okay, if you turn to Zechariah 12, verse 10. Zechariah 12, verse 10. And this is what it says. And I will pour out upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications, and they shall look upon me. Look upon me here means to look upon me in faith, whom they have pierced. No, at that time, crucifixion didn't exist. If a man lost his life in Israel, he normally lost it because he was stoned to death. That's what happened to Stephen. So how's he going to be pierced? Well, he was pierced, wasn't he? This shows that Zechariah was a true prophet. whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one that mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one is in bitterness for his firstborn. In that day there shall be great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadad-Rimon in the valley of Megiddon." That's a reference to something that happened in 609 BC. Josiah went up to engage the Egyptian forces of Pharaoh Necho. Pharaoh Necho told him not to meddle in such things. And he was speaking what God was really telling him the Pharaoh was. But Josiah did meddle in them, and he ended up losing his life. The last good king that Judah had. That's what happened. And as a result of it, the whole nation mourned for the loss of their king. And this is what it says here, that right at the end of the Great Tribulation, the land shall mourn every family apart. The family of the house of David apart and their wives apart. The family of the house of Nathan apart and their wives apart. The family of the house of Levi apart and their wives apart. The family of the house of Shammai apart and their wives apart. All the families that remain, every family apart and their wives apart. It's going to be a time of great national mourning right at the end of the Great Tribulation in these last 3 days. Okay, if you go on to Zechariah 13, verses 8 and 9. "And it shall come to pass that in all of the land, says the Lord, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third part shall be left therein." And it does say the land, and Bible scholars disagree over whether it's just saying that this happens in the land or whether it's true of the whole of Israel. If it's true of the whole of Israel, it means that two-thirds of the Israelites will die in the Great Tribulation, and only one-third will be left. And Ezekiel 20 does tell us that God is going to go through the whole nation of Israel and sort out all the rebels, and they're all going to die before the end of the Great Tribulation. Now, this explains something that appears rather strange in Matthew 25. In Matthew 25, it teaches that when Jesus comes again, he will judge the Gentile nations, the sheep and the goat judgment. You remember that parable? Why does he only judge the Gentile nations? Why doesn't he judge the nation of Israel? He doesn't need to. They've all died in the Great Tribulation. If they don't come to know Jesus as the Messiah, they will not survive till the second coming happens. They'll all be killed. So he doesn't need to judge them. He's already judged them by the Great Tribulation. There will ever be Gentiles that will survive the Great Tribulation. And if Jesus didn't judge them at that time and cause them to die, they would enter into the Millennial Kingdom. The start of the Millennial Kingdom, everybody is going to be saved. That's how it will start. We will come back to the earth in resurrected bodies, and people who survived the Great Tribulation will have children, a children who are described in the book of Psalms as a children yet to be born. And you see that 3 times in the book of Psalms, and each time it's talking about children who are going to be born in the Millennial Kingdom. Right, if you turn on to the last book of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi, people often say the prophet Malachi, he's not a prophet. Nobody knows who wrote this book, just as nobody knows who wrote the book of Hebrews. Malachi is the first Hebrew word, and originally all books of the Bible were called by the first word. And this is one that's actually retained the first word when the others haven't. The Bible was eventually translated into Greek, and they started taking the Greek titles instead of the Hebrew ones. Now in Malachi 4, it teaches this, verse 5. "Behold, I will send unto you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord." It's great and dreadful because when Jesus comes, a huge amount of people are going to be killed at that time. The Antichrist and all his armies are going to be killed at that time. And there's going to be judgment at that time where all the people will be killed who are not Christians. They will at that time go into hell. "And he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse." To turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and vice versa means to completely bring about Jewish unity. The book of Zechariah talks about the same thing, how there will be total unity at this time. Now, this is only going to happen in the last 3 days of the Great Tribulation. So if Elijah is going to be part of this, he cannot be one of the two witnesses in Revelation 11. Because the two witnesses die in the middle of the Great Tribulation. And people over the years have said the two witnesses are Moses, Elijah, Elijah, Enoch, Enoch, Moses. Elijah can't be one of them. He has to be there 3 days before the end of the Great Tribulation. So this will fulfill ultimately what Romans 11 verse 26 teaches, that all Israel will be saved. And from the time of 3 days before the Great Tribulation and throughout all the millennial kingdom, all Jews will be saved. And you may say, how can this come about? Well, it's quite simple. God's got a book up in heaven that's called the Lamb's Book of Life, and it tells you exactly who's going to be saved. So he's just going to make sure that every single Jewish person who has a baby during the millennial kingdom happens to be somebody who's in that book. It's really quite easy for him to do. That's not going to be true of the Gentiles. Some of the Gentiles in the millennial kingdom are going to still worship money. They're still going to worship luck. They're not going to do things that the Messiah says. There's still going to be some disobedience in the millennial kingdom. And those children would die at the age of 100 if they don't decide to follow the Lord. Okay, now in chapter 11, we're introduced to somebody called the beast. That's what he's called in the book of Revelation. That's what he's called in the book of Daniel. And yet today, more people refer to him by the title of the Antichrist than any other title. The word anti in Greek actually didn't mean against, it meant in place of. He's going to try to take the place of Christ. There's going to be a satanic trinity where Satan is going to act like he's the Father. The Antichrist is going to act like he's the Son. And the false prophet is going to act like he's the Holy Spirit. Now, where does the term Antichrist come from in that case, if it doesn't come from the book of Revelation or Daniel? Well, it actually comes from the teachings of John. If you turn to the first epistle of John, chapter 2 first, chapter 2 and verse 18 says this. Little children, it is the last time, or it's the last age. It's the last age before the millennial age. And as you have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now there are many Antichrists, whereby we know that we are living in the last age. Verse 22. Who is a liar but he that denies that Jesus is the Christ? He is Antichrist that denieth the Father and the Son. So one of the things he's going to do is deny that the true God really is God and that salvation really comes through the Son. He's going to claim it comes through him. Okay, on to chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Hereby know ye the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses... To confess him means to say the same thing, to say the same thing as Christ says about the subject. That Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that confesses not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist, whereof you have heard that it should come, and even now already is in the world. Now, John 2, or 2 John, I should say. Obviously, chapter 1 and verse 7. For many deceivers are entered into the world who confess not that Jesus Christ is come into the flesh. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. So here we see the different spirits of the antichrist. He exalts himself above God. He claims that he really is the person to bring salvation, and he denies the work of Christ. Now, people often get confused because they say, well, I thought the Antichrist was supposed to be one specific person who lived in the last days. How come John teaches there are many Antichrists? When John teaches there are many Antichrists, what he means is there are many people who have the same spirit as the Antichrist. An example of somebody who had the same spirit as the Antichrist was Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler actually got school teachers in Germany to teach that he was the person who resembled Jesus Christ most in the modern day German society. This is a man who led the execution of 11 million people in the Holocaust, of which 5.85 million were Jews. He also killed gypsies, he killed Jehovah's Witnesses, he killed loads and loads, I think he killed about 2 million Russian Jews or something. He killed 3 million Polish Jews. I found that out when I went to Poland earlier this year. I never realised how many Jews were killed in the Holocaust. We went to a place called Kamiras, which is about 1 kilometre away from Krakow, where we stayed for the first few days. And when we got there, Trevor, who I was with, told me that there used to be 60,000 Jews who lived in Kamira. There's several synagogues there. And today, how many live there now in Kamiras? Three. Three people when there were 60,000 Jews. Almost totally wiped out. Kamiras, by the way, is where Schindler's factory is. That's one of the reasons why we went there. Okay. So the book of Revelation calls him the beast. Where does the book of Revelation originally get this typology from? It actually gets it from the book of Daniel. When I first became a Christian, one of the first books I read was a book called 5 Minutes to Midnight by a man called Frederick Tapford. And he turned out to know an awful lot about the subject. And it was only then that I realised there were lots of prophecies about the future of Earth. I knew there was lots of prophecies about Christ's first coming. But I didn't know there were lots of prophecies about the Jews and all the things I know today. I didn't know that. I was only 18 at the time. And reading Tapford's book was the first book that really put me onto that. After that, I just wanted to keep reading books. And I brought about 120 Christian books in the first 5 years that I became a Christian. And I was buying them at a place called in Guildford at the time. It's quite a good bookshop. Today it's moved and it's terrible. I wouldn't even bother going in there anymore. I get most of my books when I go down to Bournemouth each year. But at that time it's a good bookshop, and almost every time I would come home with about 5 books, and I would read them all in a couple of months, and then I'd go back and get another 5. And I was always looking for books on the end times. And so gradually my knowledge and understanding of the end times started to increase. But one of the things I noticed was that in a lot of these books, the book of Revelation was quoted the most, but the book that was quoted the second most was the book of Daniel. So I became very interested in the book of Daniel. And when I was about 20, 21, I went up to London. I was told about this place in London where they had a great big Christian bookshop. And I brought a Bible commentary by a man called Leon Wood. To this day, it remains one of my favourite Bible commentaries on any book in the Bible. And I've still got it at home today. And that was in the 1970s I brought that book. So if we turn to Daniel chapter 1 and verse 1. Now, Daniel's main theme in his book is called the times of the Gentiles. This is a term that Jesus uses, and Luke tells us that he uses it. Is the times of the Gentiles the same thing as what Paul talks about when he talks about the fullness of the times of the Gentiles? Well, the answer to that is no, it's not. It's a completely different thing. The fullness of the times of the Gentiles that Paul talked about was a time when God would take out amongst the Gentiles a full number. That's what the word fullness means, for his name. It equates to the church age, the time from Pentecost in Acts 2 to the time of the rapture. The times of the Gentiles is more of a political thing. It's the time when the Gentile nations would have control over the nation of Israel. And according to the Bible, it starts in 605 BC with the coming of Nebuchadnezzar against Jerusalem, which is where the book of Daniel starts. And it will end when Christ will set the Jews free for good at his second coming. That's the times of the Gentiles. There will be brief times where Israel will actually managed to free itself from the yoke of the Gentiles, but they will only be brief times. One such time was between 132 BC to 63 BC. Under the Maccabeans, they eventually got rid of the yoke of the Seleucids. But in 63 BC, two men called Aristobulus and John Hyrcanus had a big fight over who was going to control Israel, basically. And they allowed the Romans to get involved. It was the worst thing they could have done. The Romans sent Ptolemy to sort things out, and from that time on, Rome controlled Israel. And they controlled Israel to the point where they eventually got rid of nearly all the Jews in the land. Right, so in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. This was in the year 605 BC. This is Nebuchadnezzar II. He reigned from 605 to 562 BC. And he was the son of a man called Nabopolassar. Now, the Babylonian kingdom really came out of the Assyrian kingdom. It was the Assyrian kingdom that was really great. Now we've got a little thing here. Can you put it up, please, for us? It became great under a man called Tiglath-Pileser III, but that's actually a title. His real name was Paul, and in the Bible, he is actually referred to as Paul. Now, for a long time, historians said that there was no such person as Paul. He didn't exist. The Bible had got it wrong. But eventually, archaeologists caught up, and I think it was a clay tablet they first discovered. And it said, Tiglath-Pileser III, whose nickname was Paul. And do you know where you can find this today? In the British Museum. And the two Chrises went with me with Jay Smith, and we actually saw it. Furthermore, in 1993, they found something else. And they said his real name was Pulu, P-U-L-U. But his nickname was Paul. Well, they did exactly what we often do. They shorten the person's name. We don't say Christopher, we say Chris. We don't say David often, we say Dave. Abigail becomes Abby. And even names like Nigel become Nige. I expect Diane's sometimes called Di. They did the same with Paul. They called him Paul for short. So it turned out the Bible was right all the time. The historians were wrong. The people who wrote the Bible were there at the time. They're the greatest experts. Even the court of law recognizes that an eyewitness is the greatest expert on what happened. Okay, now after him came Shalmaneser V. He was the person who originally started the excavation, captivity of the northern kingdom of Israel. He was the one who originally started to lead them away during the days of the king Hoshea. And that was the end of the northern kingdom. That happened in 722 BC, but he was murdered and his brother took over. His brother Sargon is actually mentioned in Isaiah chapter 20. And he reigned until 605 BC. Then Sennacherib took over. He's the person who came against Jerusalem. If you read passages like Isaiah 37, 2 Kings 18, you'll find that he came against them. Eventually, he was murdered himself. Another great king was Esarhaddon. He reigned from 681 to 669, and he is mentioned in books like Ezra. Now, Ashurbanipal isn't mentioned, but he was the last powerful king of the nation of Assyria. Now, after that, there were a couple of really weak kings who reigned, and Nabopolassar took advantage of this, and in 626 he rebelled against Assyria. And eventually, in 612, he made a covenant or made an affinity with Cyaxis, apparently his name is spelled. He was the king of the Medes. The Medes were very powerful at that time. And they led an alliance together. His son actually married Amitrus. And Amitrus was either the daughter or granddaughter of this Cyaxis. Often when they made affinities with other countries or alliances, they would allow their son to marry the other person's daughter. And this is what seems to have happened. And eventually they defeated Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, and that happened in 612. And that actually fulfilled the prophecies of who? Whose prophecies did it fulfill?
Nahum.
Nahum. Nahum's the correct answer. Nahum did prophesy those things. Isaiah prophesied the Assyrian invasion. So that's what actually happened. Now, kings of Judah during the days of these times, if we got one for the kings of Judah, I think we have. The first king of Judah is Jehoiakim. He's the one who's mentioned here. And he reigned from 608 to 597. Then we have Jehoiakin. You don't have CH sounds in Hebrew. You either pronounce the C and pronounce it as a K, or you pronounce the H, like in Hanukkah or Shekinah. And then we have, he only reigns for 3 months. He ended up in Babylon, but eventually, after Nebuchadnezzar died, Nebuchadnezzar's son, Evil-Marduk, actually treated him very well, and the book of Jeremiah actually ends telling you about him. Then came Zedekiah. Zedekiah wasn't so much an evil king, he was just pathetically weak. He was frightened of his own governors, and he liked listening to what Jeremiah had to say, but he never took any notice of him. Pretty stupid, really. And there were 3 deportations at this time. He reigned from 597 to 586. Eventually, he tried to escape from the Babylonians when Jeremiah just told him to give in. He said, if you give in, nothing bad will happen to you. Just go into Babylon, you'll be treated quite well, which is what did happen to the Jews. So he ran away. He actually ran almost the length of a marathon. He ran for 25 miles, but when he got to the 24-mile part, the Babylonians, who according to the Book of Lamentations were swifter than eagles, they had chariots, caught up with him. And he was actually blinded, his eyes were put out, and the last thing he saw before he was blinded was his own sons being executed by the Babylonians. So there were 3 deportations. The one in 605 is the one that's mentioned here, where Daniel and his 3 buddies went. The one in 597 is the one where Jehoiakim and the prophet Ezekiel also were deported at that time. And the one in 586 is where they actually destroyed the original Solomonic temple. Now the Babylonians thought that their gods were superior to the gods of Israel. If you beat somebody else in battle, you consider that you are superior to them. That's exactly what Islam believe. And that is why there's been so much trouble about the land of Israel. Because for 400 years, the land of Israel was the property of the Ottoman Turks. They invaded it in 1517 for a man called Suleiman the Magnificent, as he called himself, and they had it for 400 years. And yet, eventually, the British, after making a declaration called the Balfour Declaration, acted on that and drove the Ottoman Turks out. According to all Islamic teachings, that's impossible. Their God is greater than anybody else's, therefore they cannot possibly lose in battle. But they did lose. They even sent a man called Allenby in to lead the British troops. And the Muslims thought his name was Allenby, meaning let it be the will of Allah. So a lot of them wouldn't even fight because they thought it must be the will of Allah. But in reality, this contradicts all Islamic beliefs. In 1967, Jordan, Syria, and Egypt declared war on Israel, and they outnumbered Israel 6-1. And yet Israel had completely defeated them in 6 days, showing that our God really is the true God. What does Amos 9 teach? That God will plant them again in the land, and that nobody will ever be able to drive them out. Now, the book of Daniel is split up into 2 sections. The first section is called the historical section, chapters 1-6. And an incident happens in all those chapters that show that the true God of Israel is the one true God. He shows himself superior in every one of those 6 chapters. In the first chapter, he shows himself superior as a result of their food experiment. In the second chapter, he shows himself superior by Daniel being the person who can interpret the dreams when none of their holy men can. In the third chapter, he shows himself superior when 3 men are thrown into a fiery furnace, and yet a man called the Son of Man comes into their midst. Only 2 people in the Bible are ever called the Son of Man, the prophet Ezekiel and the Messiah. In the fourth chapter, he shows himself superior by turning Nebuchadnezzar basically into an animal. He actually suffered from a mental illness called bianthropy, where a person thinks they're an ox. In chapter 5, he showed himself superior when Daniel alone could read the writing on the wall. And in chapter 6, he showed himself superior when Daniel survived the test of the lion's den. There he showed himself superior to the Persians' gods, because by then Persia were under control. Now chapter 2 of the book of Daniel, and we're not going to cover it in any great length today because we haven't got time. But chapter 2 of Daniel is the first chapter of 4 chapters on the theme of the times of the Gentiles. Now, people often say, I don't understand the book of Revelation. And they say, I don't understand Revelation 17. Well, the reason why you don't understand Revelation 17 is because you don't understand Revelation 13, which is the third chapter on the book of the times of the Gentiles. Well, I don't understand Revelation 13. Well, the reason why you don't understand Revelation 13 is because it takes a lot of its stuff from Daniel 7, the second chapter on the times of the Gentiles. Well, I don't understand Daniel chapter 7. Well, that's because you don't understand the first chapter on the chapter of the times of the Gentiles in Daniel chapter 2. You don't have to be very clever to understand chapter 2 of the book of Daniel, because Daniel tells you exactly what everything means. So all you've got to do is read it and you'll understand it. Well, we haven't got time to read it today, so that will have to wait till next time when we'll look at what Daniel teaches in Daniel chapters 2 and 7, and we'll find that he starts to teach things about the Antichrist that have never been revealed previously. And that's it.